Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
So, this week we are tackling the controversial and confusing topic of surveillance capitalism. That's a phrase some of our listeners might have heard before. Some of them will have never heard it before. And I suspect most of them might not be entirely clear on what it means. Before we get started on this roller coaster, do you want to try and give us a kind of pithy one sentence definition of what on earth we're talking about when we talk about surveillance capitalism?
Well, I'll try. I mean, it is one of those extraordinarily complex and often confusing ideas. But I think at the heart of it, it's a really good name because it's those two things. It's surveillance. It's a new kind of making, a new way of making money, which is all about the surveillance of billions of pieces of data, if not trillions of pieces of data, about billions of human beings, and then basically using that both to predict how people are going to behave and to manipulate how they're going to behave, to actually change how they're going to behave. And it's all about making money. And it's basically a small number of people making obscene amounts of money from this technology. I mean, Google was the font of this, started it all. And I think you had some figures about how much they'd made, didn't you, from advertising?
Yes, it's astonishing. I was just reading something before. In 2020, I'm sure it's grew even more since then, particularly with the pandemic, Google, which we think of as a company which is fundamentally about, you know, it's a search engine and it's an email provider, and they make kind of software that you might use on your work computer or, you know, a calendar app on your phone. But what they really are, they're an advertising company. In 2020, Google made $147 billion in advertising. $147 billion in advertising. And it's that money, you know, adverts primarily placed into your search results, which funds all their other activity, you know, which is why they make, you know, phones and smart doorbells and, you know, maybe one day driverless cars. It's all a result of them being effectively an enormous money-making machine just by selling adverts online.
And what's really interesting to me is that if you go back into the history of Google and of other Silicon Valley pioneers, they come out of a very different kind of mindset. I mean, it was very much the hippie era, and its consequences. And there was a great deal of sort of idealism about making a new world with technology, and it was going to be a new world where everything was going to be open, free, and there was this idea that we're going to remove all the shackles, we're going to make everything available, everything's free.
And it comes, as you say, it's this really fascinating kind of melange of that kind of idealistic kind of post-1960s hippie-ish counterculture. And then it gets somehow bolted onto what you might even call kind of hyper laissez-faire capitalism, you know, unregulation. You know, you can do whatever you want as long as it makes you a profit. And it kind of starts to merge into this almost a system with almost unintended consequences. You know, when you look back at the start of Google, it's these two kind of long-haired, kind of slightly nerdy computer science engineers in the mid-1990s. You had this idea of a really clean, minimalist search engine, which would just give people the best results first. And, you know, I think their early slogan was, you know, don't be evil, or something kind of like kind of charmingly naive and childish like that. And over time, they realized, well, we just put an advert right at the top of your search list. It that makes us a bit of money. And then they realized, actually, hang on, we can make a lot more money by putting another advert in there. And then maybe we could start checking how people click on the adverts and how long they click and what kind of people are clicking on that. And it just kind of ratchets on step by step. Before, and now you see the Google today, you know, one of the most profitable, powerful companies in the world. It's hard to kind of trace it back to those kind of utopian underpinnings.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting reading those early, about the early years. The problem that everybody had was what they called monetization. How do I, I've got this wonderful technology. It's absolutely amazing. And we can give people really good search, you know, because before Google, search was very, very kludgy and often, you know, just very unhelpful. And so the technology, the way that Google worked, it was giving much better search results, but it was all costing money. You need massive computer servers to do this and computer coders and all the rest. How on earth are we going to make money? How are we going to fund this? And it sounds like initially they were really very resistant to this advertising model because they thought once we're advertising, people won't trust us. People will think, oh, this is all, you know, the search has been corrupted by money. But eventually, they realized that the extraordinary earning potential and the rest is history. And but it then feeds on itself because as the venture capitalists come in and put large sums of money into Google, they are demanding massive returns. And so everything then becomes orientated towards increasing. And I think a vital factor of this was the discovery of how to manipulate people, how to hook them in and how to manipulate their behavior.
Yeah. I mean, people probably heard of the phrase, you know, if it's free, you are the product. And that's really at the heart of how big tech, big data, surveillance capitalism works, which is that people are enticed in to use ostensibly free products, whether that's Google search or Instagram or a Facebook account. And then the question is, if it's free, how does Facebook, Google make money? And what people kind of maybe vaguely aware and aren't necessarily clear on is that they're monetized by the companies harvesting data on them and then selling it to advertisers who then use that data to better target their adverts. So, you know, to carry on using the Google example, you know, Google at first probably just started selling, you know, you would Google a lawnmower and a lawnmower company out there would pay Google a certain amount of money to put links to their lawnmowers in the search results, you know, which is, you know, reasonable. You can assume that someone typing in lawnmower is looking for lawnmowers. But over time, Google starts to collect more and more data about you. It says, well, what kind of computer are you using to search lawnmower? What time of day is it? Whereabouts in the world are you? What have you searched just before? And what are you about to search just after? What did you do yesterday? And agglomerates this huge quantity of data that they can then make incredibly specific profiles. And then they go to the lawnmower company and say, would you like to sell your lawnmower adverts, not just to anyone looking for lawnmowers, but to, you know, men in the UK between the ages of 28 and 35 who have, you know, earn at least £30,000 a year, you know, and they can narrow it down to these incredibly thin salami slices of the population and then find that is in intensely more lucrative and profitable, both for them because they can sell the adverts for more, but also for the lawnmower companies who gets to put their product in the front of people, very specific slices of the population.
It's not only that, but then the brilliance of Google was not only have we got your search results, but we've got what you've been, we can see on Gmail what you've been sending off emails about. And because you've been using Google Maps, we can see where you've been traveling and what you've done and so on and so on. And we can aggregate all this data, which gives us, and if you've got an Android phone, well, actually Google did the operating system. So we've got taps into that and we know what you're doing with your Android phone and so on and so on. So it's an incredibly powerful, very sophisticated model and incredibly successful. And of course, it is absolutely wonderful. What it has given us is mind-blowing. The idea that all of this is apparently free, that we have this amazing technology and software, we can do a search about anything, which would previously, you know, cost an enormous amount of money, and it's utterly free.
I mean, when you were my age and you wanted to find something out, you had to go to a literal library and ask a human librarian, you know, I want to find out what's the population of Azerbaijan. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, let's go and dig out the latest version of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's absolutely right. You know, and I would spend a day. You would spend a day to go into the library. And I mean, you had to do most of the searching yourself, you know, and I spent hours going along dusty shelves, you know, trying to find a particular journal article or a newspaper article, you know, with microfiche, a kind of miniaturized photography, you were going through with scanners to try and find a newspaper article. And it took hours and hours. On the other hand, there was the amazing thrill when you actually find, you know, I can't believe it. After 2 hours, I've found this amazing article and it's really wonderful. You know?
Whereas I just opened a new tab on my Google Chrome browser, typed in population Azerbaijan, and in 0.69 seconds, it came back to tell me it's 10.14 million people, which is quicker, faster, simpler, is not quite as romantic.
That's absolutely right.
But it has, on the surface of it, you're right, it's given us an incredible service. And I take it for granted because I've grown up with this. You know, Google has been the kind of dominant search product for all my entire life. It's just, you know, it's almost second nature and it's extension on my hand. It's now the phone in my pocket. If I ever have a factual question, I can think of it and just tap it in and get the answer. And many people will say, okay, they're harvesting my data, they're gathering all this information points about my life, but it's a pretty good deal because I get all this incredible products in reverse. My life has been immeasurably improved by free access to Google products. Why should we care about surveillance capitalism if that's the exchange? That seems like a pretty good deal.
Well, it's basically about advertising, isn't it? Once you this is, of course, advertising predates massively all this. It goes back, you know, to the 18th century, I should think, and so on. But it's once you have an entire economy which is based on advertising, it really has unintended consequences, doesn't it? And I'd be really interested in your perspective as a journalist about how advertising and digital advertising has changed the nature of journalism.
Mm. Yeah, it's something that I spend quite a lot of time thinking and reading about because, for obvious reasons, what is interesting is what I've kind of read and discovered is that historically the kind of news industry has actually always been funded by adverts. You know, the very first, you know, the mass market newspapers, which kind of arose in the later 1800s, they were sold deliberately quite cheap. So they were affordable to the kind of everyday working man, maybe a halfpenny or something to buy the paper. That's where they built up huge circulations of maybe many millions of people each day were buying these papers. And then they would be crammed full of adverts. And it was those companies, you know, your classic Victorian companies selling, you know, Dr. So-and-so's magical elixir and whatever else that actually funded the vast number of journalists and printers and all that stuff to run it. And that model worked pretty well. It meant that, you know, everyone got what they wanted. The news was very cheap and accessible, and it worked very well for about 100 years or so. And then the advent of digital advertising has had these vast unintended consequences. And at first, everyone moved onto the internet and just started giving away their news for free. You know, all these broadsheet tabloid newspapers, the BBC, they all set up internet sites in the 90s and early noughties. And just because that was the ethic, like we said, of the internet at the time was, well, we wouldn't pay to use the internet. They were like, well, we'll just put our news on the internet for free. And at first, that was a kind of very niche thing. It didn't matter because they were still selling lots and lots of papers. But then over time, people stopped buying newspapers, in part because they could access the same content online for free. And the thought was, fine, well, we'll just start putting on online adverts on those news websites. But the distinction there is that because we can gather so much data, you know, in the old days, you would say to a, you know, an old firm, just give us X amount of money and we'll put a half page advert on page 17 of the newspaper and that'll cost this much. And they just had to hope that people flicking through would read their advert and say, and a certain number of those people buying the paper would then go on to buy the product. And that's why advertising worked. But with the online, we can track exactly how many people have seen the advert, who is clicking on it, how successful it was in terms of generating revenue. They quickly found out that most advertising doesn't really work very well. But also it meant that there was huge incentives now for the newspapers to juice up their numbers because they could only sell, they could only justify what they were charging the advertisers if they could say, and here's our, you know, accredited number of hits that each right. page got.
So there's this big pressure to increase your it's now an incredibly competitive game. We're all fighting for eyeballs, as they say,
yeah,
and for clicks, and so what's the implications of that?
the implications for that is that it basically creates these kind of perverse incentives, whereas before you would say, I spend my money and my news resource, I tell my journalist to cover what I think is most newsworthy, because we're creating a single daily product. Whereas now we're really creating thousands of individual articles, which most people just click on and leave. They don't browse the whole website. So each article needs to be able to justify its existence. And what you find is that, you know, deeply reported 3-month kind of investigative pieces of thousands of words don't get the same number of hits as something you can bang out in 10 minutes saying, what is this celebrity wearing today? Here's 14,000 pictures. And because you get more money depending on more hits, you're inevitably, the center of gravity of the paper is drawn, as much as the journalists individually might not like this, towards his ex-celebrity wearing not very many clothes, because that's incredibly cheap to produce and gets loads of hits and eyeballs, whereas your, you know, sending your foreign correspondent to South Sudan to cover the civil war is incredibly expensive and doesn't produce more eyeballs. And that's why you get the kind of people chasing, trying to get their content to go viral. That's why you have, you know, newspapers being reduced to this kind of clickbait stuff where it's kind of tricking you with misleading headlines or pictures. Yeah,
I mean, that was something which I found really quite shocking going onto some of these websites. You know, several very well-known name newspaper websites. You go onto them and you're just confronted with this amazing clickbait adverts. I mean, and you think this, the impression it's giving of something that is cheap, that is unreliable, that is just out to trap you, it is really, I'm amazed that that papers will stand for that and see their image being trashed by this clickbait.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways I agree. It's really quite depressing to see, kind of, as you say, kind of news brands that ostensibly stood for kind of quality and they are, to this point, there are some papers which are basically unreadable because they have, you know, add videos that slide in front of your eyes and they'll track you as you scroll down the screen. And there's this arms race, you know, because we quickly discovered just putting static banner ads at the top, people just glaze over them. So the price of those plummeted because they weren't working. So then we started having videos and then the browser started cancelling auto-playing videos. And there's this kind of arms race where each side, the advertisers and the consumer, is trying to avoid, and then the adverts get more and more intrusive. And ultimately, the other angle of this is that particularly when it comes to local news, local papers obviously relied on local businesses to advertise in them. But local businesses very quickly discovered you get loads more bang for your buck by advertising on Google or on Facebook and selling directly there, because Google and Facebook can find people who live in your particular village who want that particular kind of lawnmower or whatever. And so all the advertising revenue moved away from local newspapers to Google and to Facebook, and basically eviscerated the business model of local news. And so it's slightly been hidden because, you know, the national papers that we all understand, you know, your big name newspapers are still going strong online. But across the Western world, particularly in the UK and the US, there's been an absolute devastation. You know, the newspapers that might have once, you know, I started my career at a local newspaper, which today has maybe 2 or 3 journalists, and as recently as 15 years ago would have had 8 or 9, you know. So we're talking 75% loss in, and they're trying to produce the same number of pages, if not more, while also running a website, while also running a social media channels. You know, they're doing 10 times the work with 20% of the resources, but it produces a worse product, and you get stuck in this death spiral because people are like, why would I buy this local rag which is full of clickbait and viral nonsense that they've scraped off the internet, doesn't even cover our local news anymore? And then it gets you just stuck in the cycle where, you know, fewer people read it, there's even less revenue from advertising, and it becomes a death spiral.
And so journalism sounds like almost a doomed profession. Well, certainly local journalism. I mean, do you feel that? Do you feel?
I think journalism, yes, I think local journalism is largely a doomed profession. I don't think it will cease to exist entirely, but I think the kind of the local journalism that you grew up with, where every town had a local newspaper, maybe two, that was staffed by professional trained journalists who would, you know, go to your council meetings and go to the courts and follow up on what's going on in local businesses and write about that, that won't really exist in any meaningful sense, certainly in the next 20 years.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So again, it's interesting, isn't it? It's unintended consequences. Something that starts off just aiming to make profit for Google and for these other internet providers has all kinds of devastation. I mean, you could tell a similar story about bookstores, couldn't you? And yeah. You know, there are many other areas of retail that have just been completely devastated by this unanticipated consequences. I think one of the things I'm really worried about is this addictive ability. I'm really interested in the science of this, because it's not an accident that smartphones are incredibly addictive. I mean, you know, you try and remove a smartphone from a 15-year-old, and younger people find it simply inconceivable not to be living with their smartphone. And I think we all do. I mean, it is a very, very sticky product, is what they call it. And none of this is by accident. This is by engineering. And it's interesting, because a lot of this goes back to very early work, which I learned when I was studying psychology as part of my medical training way back in the 1970s. And at the time, there was a lot of interest, and I read all these papers about what was called behaviorism, animal behaviorism. And in particular, there was a guy called B.F. Skinner, who was the leading proponent. And it was Skinner who had worked out ways of conditioning pigeons and rats in boxes to press buttons. And there was a whole science of behavior modification. And one of the experiments I remember is that what you do is you put a pigeon in a box, and there happens to be a lever situated in the box. And every time the lever is pressed, it produces a little food pellet. And the pigeon just goes around randomly fluttering and exploring and trying to escape. And then by accident, it touches this lever, and then a pellet appears. And then what Skinner did was he plotted how the frequency, and initially it only happened occasionally. And then gradually the pigeon works out that by pecking on this particular area, he can make the food pellets bit. And then Skinner did all kinds of different experiments to see whether he could, you know, whether it mattered the shape of the target, if it was a different target quite separate from where the pellet appeared. But one of the things that he discovered was that if every time the pigeon pecked on the pellet, pecked on the target, the pellet appeared, the pecking rose to a peak, a maximum, and then quite rapidly fell down. The pigeon got bored. But if he put in a variable so that most of the time when the pigeon pecked on the pellet, nothing appeared on the target, but just occasionally one at random appeared, what he discovered was that the pigeons kept on pecking and pecking and pecking and pecking. And sometimes I think they would almost exhaust themselves in simply just pecking on the pellet. And this kind of science has been incorporated into the design of the internet, and in particular into smartphones, ways of getting us to press on particular on apps and so on. And it is extraordinary to think this quite sophisticated science, but it's all hidden, it's all covert. And that's what really concerns me. It's almost like heroin. We've worked out a way of trapping people and getting them into this addictive cycle. One of the fascinating ideas is that part of the way this works is through notifications. And so what everybody tries to get us to switch on notifications. At the moment, I have notifications switched off, and the number of times that all the apps tell me, you know, just switch on notifications. You appear to have notifications switched off, you know, just press here. And of course, the reason for that is that every time that little ping goes or that little vibration, it is a cue, a trigger for us to go and check. Oh, what was that? I wonder who's Facebooked me. I wonder who's, you know, I wonder what that news item is and so on. But their goal is to get what they call internal triggers. So those are external triggers, the notification is. But the goal is to get us at the internal triggers. And the internal trigger is, you know what? I haven't checked my WhatsApp for at least an hour. I really need to go and check it. And so we are prompting ourselves. We are triggering ourselves. I need to go and check that website. I need to go and do that. It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. Well, it's kind of sinisterly brilliant. And it really, because it what it very specifically does is it targets our emotions and our almost our cognitive biases and our insecurities and our anxieties. You know, you see this very clearly in social media platforms, particularly ones like Instagram based around visual elements, where the whole app is geared towards you snapping a picture, taking a picture of something and putting it on there for your followers, your friends to see. And then the whole point is that all what everyone does in response is they click like or they comment. You get a notification and it goes bing. Someone has paid you attention. Someone has complimented you. Someone has said, great picture, or like that, or, you know, and that gives you a little shot of dopamine, and then it feeds, and then you go away, and then after an hour, you're like, I wonder if anyone else has liked that. And it just scratches that little itch that we all have inside ourselves, which is a desire to be loved, a desire to be noticed, a desire to be valued and wanted. And then you're like, well, I posted that last picture a couple of hours ago, and there was a stream of likes, but now it's kind of fizzled out. People have swiped down. I probably should post something else. And you get sucked into posting and posting and posting. And then you get this feedback loop of likes and comments, a little hit of dopamine in your brain, a ping on your phone, a vibration in your pocket. And they found, as you say, this basically model of, you know, hook people in with a free product, get them to generate the content for yourself, give them positive reinforcement, and then they go back. And we are effectively pigeons tapping at levers. But instead of lapping at levers getting a pellet, we're posting stuff online and receiving hearts and likes and stars and pings and vibrations. And it's kind of instrumentalizing the kind of brokenness of the human brain.
It is. And our vulnerability and weaknesses as flawed and broken human beings. And I think, you know, we're coming to the end of this episode. I just want to flag up this extraordinary asymmetry of power. So, you know, we've talked about the self-feeding way that this works in these big silicon companies before, but because they're making so much money, they're able to buy up the best talent, the best coders, the best equipment, the best computers, the best ideas. And also they pay enormous lobbying. I mean, Google and the Silicon Valley companies apparently have the biggest lobbying budgets in Washington. And they are constantly lobbying politicians to try and protect their own interests. And so on the one hand, you've got this brilliant science, engineering, power. And on the other hand, you've got the poor consumer, you know, with their smartphone trying to decide whether to click or not on this very alluring button. And it does seem an extraordinary asymmetry there. And it does seem that part of the way forward must be to try and balance the power, to say, okay, you're trying to make me click on this button. I want to know some more information. Why? What? How are you doing this? And what's behind it? And is this actually something that's going to be for my good?
Hmm. And it's interesting because when you talk about asymmetry of power, there's a part of me that kind of instinctively recoils and says, well, hang on, I'm a autonomous, educated adult person. You know, I'm not that easily manipulated. You know, I'm not having this little app on my phone. I'm not a puppet dancing to its tune. But then you start to read about, you know, the social media companies have done quite a lot of research into how they can manipulate behavior through their apps and their device and their products. And it is terrifying how effective, you know, Facebook did one about voter turnout a few years ago, where in certain parts of the state, so there was an election season, and they experimented with giving different people in different towns different notifications about go and vote, don't go and vote, what size was the picture, you know, what voting, how would they promote kind of political content in their feed, and then they measured turnout in different towns, and they were literally able to reduce or boost voter turnout and effectively the result of democratic elections simply by tweaking settings in how people's Facebook feeds worked. And no one is obviously consciously realizing that, but in aggregate, they're literally able to steer the future of that country on these local elections based on you know, minute changes in your Facebook feed, which is quite a sobering and terrifying thought.
It certainly is. And when, you know, there's this concern about democracy around the world being under threat, It's ironic, isn't it, that this hidden threat through technology, and of course, you know, governments around the world and political agents and all the rest are well aware of the potential that this has. And so, I mean, the larger philosophical question is it possible for democracy to survive if in the end our behavior is so open to manipulation by these covert forces?
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
It's a very hard thing to define, isn't it? Because it's like almost like, you know, asking a fish to define what it means to live in water. Yeah. This is just absolutely just ubiquitous, isn't it?
Swimming in this soup.
We're swimming in it, and it's almost invisible to us. But yeah, it's about surveillance and its primary use to make obscene sums of money for advertisers and technology companies. But of course, I'm interested in this surveillance is not just being used by these companies, but also by governments around the world, because they've discovered that exactly the same technology, which is used to track you and work out where you've been, so they can sell and advertise to you and manipulate your behavior. That's extremely valuable information for governments. And it's well known that China in particular has become extremely sophisticated surveillance technology. It has a number of capitalist companies in China doing the same kind of thing that Silicon Valley companies do. But unlike those, it has a much more overt relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. And there's lots of evidence showing how they are using the same kind of technology for basically for social control, which is what communist governments have always wanted to try to do, to understand what every member of society is doing and ensure that what they're doing is not against the interests of the Communist Party. And this technology gives the most unbelievably powerful tools to authoritarian governments.
I mean, people are familiar with, you know, under the 20th century form of communism, you know, Eastern European, the Soviet Union countries, they had extensive kind of surveillance networks where they would, you know, use analog technology to bug people's apartments and listen in on private conversations. And what we're seeing in the 21st century is another form of communism, the kind of bizarro, hyper-capitalistic, yet authoritarian communism espoused by the Chinese Communist Party, which is now, you know, it's not installing little radio listening devices in your apartment. It's just looking at everything that you're tapping on your smartphone screen. It's watching everything that you're emailing. It's hoovering up all the data about where you're going. You know, in China, particularly exacerbated by the pandemic, but even before, it's quite ubiquitous sense of when you go into public spaces or restaurants or shops, you often scan QR codes. And part of that during the pandemic was to show that you weren't kind of COVID positive or whatever. But it also means that there is an exact record on a government accessible database where they can see where every citizen is going, who they're meeting up with. This person has left their city where they normally live and has gone to another place, and they're met up with this other person. And, you know, you can see how that's incredibly useful for suppressing kind of political opposition, but also that kind of just granular, fine-tuned, just sense of oppressive sense of everything is being watched, everything is under scrutiny, you're never truly alone, you're never truly private.
Yeah, one of the fascinating things, isn't it, that the smartphone now becomes the most dangerous thing for the dissident or for anyone who might be regarded as having a difference with their government, because your smartphone contains absolutely all the information about who you're in contact with, where you've been, what posts you've been making, what apps you have.
You know, I've heard stories of people we've heard of the tragic genocide that China is perpetuating against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. And one of the things they often do is they're trying to stamp out expressions of kind of Muslimness. And, you know, Uyghur Muslims have learned, you know, they've got to shave their beards and not wear Islamic clothing, but often they get pulled over at checkpoints. And the first things that the state security forces will do is look at your phone and see if you have a Quran app on your phone. You know, something as innocent as that is incriminating enough to get sent off to a re-education camp.
Apparently similar things happening in the war in Ukraine, where, you know, there's a lot of worry about informers on both sides, and the military authorities are insisting that they check through your smartphone because it's so incriminating.
Yeah.
There was another twist that it was particularly concerning, is that it seems so often it's journalists in authoritarian regimes who are being targeted, isn't it? So yeah. Your profession is one of the most vulnerable and dangerous professions. And there was a whole thing about the use of software called Pegasus, wasn't it, and the ability to interrogate someone's smartphone.
Yeah, that was a scandal a year or two ago where an Israeli firm had developed this software called Pegasus, which is exceptionally powerful spyware, which is able to kind of penetrate the security built into even iPhones, which are kind of historically the most kind of secure brand of phone you can have, where they would original version of software, they would just send a text message to someone, as long as you had their phone number. The person didn't even have to open the message. Just as soon as it landed on their phone, it exploited holes in the software and allowed the person using Pegasus to read your texts, to listen to your voicemails, to observe you in real time as you tap on different apps as you write things. And you know, the theory was, oh, we're just going to give this to, you know, the CIA and Mossad and kind of reputable Western intelligence agencies while they're targeting terrorists. But the scandal came out that actually this Israeli company had sold it to governments like Saudi Arabia and Tunisia. And it got into the hands of some quite bad people who had used it to target, as you say, very often journalists. I think infamously, even Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who was executed, who was assassinated by the Saudi regime for his dissident journalism, and other journalists have found that you know, all they needed was your phone number. That's all they needed, and then they basically could look inside your phone and turn your own smartphone into a kind of a bug on your life.
And of course, there's all this evidence that Western governments have also been involved in hoovering up vast amounts of our data and using it. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it? If Google can work out what your political affiliations are, what your religious views are, where you live, how you spend your money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that any government is going to be extremely interested in that kind of information as well.
Yeah.
And they would be mad not to be using the same kind of technology.
I mean, could you even argue potentially it would be a dereliction of their duty, you know? If the bad guys have this information, if the Silicon Valley tech companies have this information, can GCHQ or America's NSA, these spy agencies who are tasked with, you know, finding the bad guys and preventing terrorist threats and attacks on us, would it be a dereliction of duty for them not to tap into this fire hose of data and use it for their own ends?
And I think that brings us on to this question about privacy, doesn't it? Whether or not, I mean, so often the standard response to this, which has come both from Christians and from, you know, civil society quotes from classic liberals and other people, has been that this is outrageous. We have, as citizens, we surely have a right of privacy. I mean, it's one of our human rights. And we must insist that we're able to live our lives without other people knowing what we're doing, without governments or tech companies or anybody. Privacy is a fundamental human right.
And it's a compelling, I find it in personally quite a compelling case, you know, that, you know, the argument goes, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. But the reality is that actually we'd all feel deeply uncomfortable if the intimate contents of our digital lives, you know, this is no longer just, you know, people live their lives through their smartphones, through their Gmail accounts, through their WhatsApp Messenger app. You know, they're sending deeply, deeply private stuff that they don't want anyone else to find out. And the idea that it is sitting accessible on some government server somewhere is deeply unsettling.
Yeah, and I find myself very conflicted on this, you know, because obviously as a medic, right from, you know, medical school days, we're all trained in the importance of medical confidentiality. And that is a very, very important principle of medical ethics. Interestingly, it goes back all the way to Hippocrates, the Hippocratic group of pagan physicians back several hundred years before Christ. And the original Hippocratic Oath actually says something like, I will keep every information about my patients as a most holy secret, and I will not divulge it to anybody else on pain of death. And so you know, those early physicians recognized that medical information was incredibly, could be incredibly damaging if this was released. And therefore, the physician has an ethical duty to maintain strict confidentiality. And that still happens through to today. But, you know, the other side of it is, if you think back to life in a village, as it must have been all the way until urbanization starts, I suspect that privacy was a bit of a myth. I think that in your village, everybody knows what everybody's going on. I mean, think of Miss Marple, looking underneath the lace curtains to see who's going off to whom and who's having an affair with who. So it's not until you get urbanization of people living in large conurbations that it becomes possible that I can actually shut my door and go behind my closed door and nobody knows, because I've now got anonymity. I'm living in a large city.
That's the thing. Privacy is really an outworking of the alienation of kind of contemporary industrialized society, because, you know, it, as you say, not only does everyone in a village is privacy impossible, but also everyone has grown up together. And so they are intimately known and know everyone around them. Whereas it's only when the rural people start up sticks and move into some anonymous terraced block quickly thrown up to work in the factory, and they're side by side with people from other parts of the country, from hundreds of miles away, who they are complete strangers to. And you have these brick walls and these tiny windows. And really, it's that kind of anonymity and the alienation from each other enables the idea, the modern conception of a private individual life to develop. Whether that's a positive thing is probably a separate question.
But also, maybe it was just a phase in the development of society, and it happened to last for, you know, a couple of centuries when urbanization started and yet technology hadn't advanced. And maybe we've now got to a stage where, even though we're all now, or most of us are urbanized, the technology is now, we're back in the digital village. Everybody knows everybody's business. Everything is open to us. And maybe we just have to accept, maybe that this, it seems to me that the quest for privacy is almost like a longing, a romantic longing for a sort of agrarian age, some romantic idea of the past, which I suspect has gone forever.
I think there's definitely elements of truth to that, but I would counter by saying the key distinction between hyper-modern, late capitalistic lack of privacy that we experience today and the lack of privacy in a kind of pre-industrial agrarian village is that in the village, it's only a tiny number of people, a few hundred at most, who have this intimate knowledge about your whereabouts and who you're sleeping with and what you're eating and what and all that kind of stuff. Whereas today, we're saying potentially that the digital technology allows agglomeration and scale that is unimaginable. You know, it's one thing for all your neighbors to know intimate details about your personal life, but it's another thing for your government, the ruling authority, let alone a distant tech company in another country, to have accumulated this knowledge about you. And I think we have to think about the, as you talked about last week, the power imbalance. You know, there was a democraticness of the unprivate village, because
democraticness. Democracy, yes, go on.
There was a democracy about the unprivate village, the public life, because it was shared. You knew your neighbour and your neighbour knew your life. But today, anonymous government bureaucrat at GCHQ or tech worker in Silicon Valley knows everything about my life, and I don't even know that they exist.
No, I accept that. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. It's just that I find it very hard to imagine how you go back, you know, how you, once these things are learned, there's this extraordinary thing about technology, isn't it? Is that it has this degree of irreversibility. Once we live in a world where there are surveillance cameras everywhere, where GPS is constantly, you know, satellites are logging on, where we're logging into masts, mobile phone masts, where, you know, my number plate as soon as I get in my car is being tracked and monitored and so on. How do you go back to a situation, a way of living where nobody knows what anybody else is doing? I find it very hard to imagine, apart unless you do take the sort of Amish view. You say, we're going to take this little area in the States, we're going to map it out. This is going to be our place. But even then, of course, it wouldn't be. The surveillance cameras, you can't stop external surveillance. So it seems to me the question then shifts to, given that this kind of surveillance is a reality and is going to continue, then it's who holds the power? Who decides what this data is being used for? It is being collected. We can't stop it being collected. But in a democratic society, we can have some say in how my data is being used.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the Amish is a good example, because ultimately, I think most people wouldn't want to turn the clock back to a pre-industrial agrarian idyll, because you would no longer have Facebook scraping your data, but you also wouldn't have, you know, any of the other accoutrements of modern capitalistic life. This is in many ways that what we live in today is the logical, inevitable outworking of capitalism itself. You know, I think one of the most intriguing things I was read researching for this about surveillance capitalism was the idea that actually we focus on the surveillance, but the key is really the capitalism. You know, it's the modern system of you know, the private free enterprise and accumulation of profit that has driven these companies to create these systems of surveillance and data harvesting, because it makes them a lot of money. And ultimately, why does it make them money? Because advertisers pay them to do it. Why do advertisers have that money to pay them? Because we buy the advertisers' products. It all comes back to us, the consumer. We are the bottom of the pyramid. And it is our, you know, you could argue, rapacious overconsumption, which has generated the wealth, which is now being used to target our lives for surveillance.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, and this is deeply confusing and troubling, isn't it? Because capitalism has many faults and so on, but it has led to the most extraordinary growth in living standards, improvement in health, in social welfare, increasing longevity, and so on. And yet, particularly once you're into this kind of consumerist capitalism, it's all about the manipulation of desire. Ultimately, what adverts do is they are designed to generate discontent. They're designed to tap into your desires and say, you know what, I really need XYZ, and I feel dissatisfied, I feel unhappy with what I've got, you know, whatever it is, I need that new thing. And, you know, I can sense in myself how well it works, you know, where my vulnerability is to a nice new piece of tech or to this wonderful new book, you know, which Google seems to have worked out with extraordinary, and Amazon with, you know, extraordinary ability of how exactly the kind of books that I'm going to desire, or the kind of tech which will appeal to me. And so this then the question is, what is all this doing to me as a human being and to me as a follower of Christ?
Yeah, and I think that's, for me, perhaps a more compelling critique of surveillance capitalism. While, you know, I'm not ecstatic about the loss of privacy and that kind of thing, I think I'm more concerned by this idea of how it is corrupting us, potentially even, you know, marring the image of God in us. It is playing into our kind of most broken insecurities, our avaricious desires. It is ratcheting up our anxiety and insecurity, as we talked about last week. You know, it's this endless pit of, we're never fulfilled, and yet we keep coming back to the well of these apps, but they never truly satisfy. It creates this kind of, it's kind of, it instrumentalizes it. It turns human beings into means, not ends. It kind of strips us of our dignity, and we're just an accumulation of billions of data points that can be chopped up, marketed, sold to a data broker, gone through three different middlemen, and then farted back at us in the face of some vacuous product mass produced in some Chinese warehouse by wage slaves. And, you know, it really is quite dehumanizing in a way.
I think it really is dehumanizing. And again, it is also runs completely antithetical to the Christian virtue of contentment. You know, that this idea that being contented with my lot is a fundamental Christian sense. Contentment with godliness is great gain. And yet, from a consumerist capitalist point of view, contentment is a disaster. If everybody was contented, the entire structure of consumerist economics would crash and burn. We need people to be discontented. We need people to be longing and desiring for whatever it is, whatever taps into their values, their longings, and so on. So that's a deeply troubling thought, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that really ties into what is quite well established now, which is how detrimental the surveillance capitalism ecosystem is to our mental health, particularly for the younger people. You know, it's well established that the more time, you know, teenagers spend on apps like Instagram and Facebook, the greater the likelihood they will develop, you know, depression and anxiety. And we all kind of wring our hands about that and, you know, have a lot of intense social debate what to do about that. But fundamentally, it's largely because these apps are, as you say, they are designed not only to be addictive, but to be unfulfilling and to keep drawing us back and to keep never quite fully satisfying that itch, playing into our neuroses and our brokenness.
It's particularly this sort of bizarre effect of watching other people having a great time, isn't it? So watching other people having this most amazing family and holiday or experiences or eating this amazing meal, the effect on us is, again, to stimulate envy, to stimulate discontent.
Yeah. What would we call FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. Yeah. And that's really this modern language for, as you say, the kind of pride of the sin of envy and jealousy. And we all know in our heads that what we see online is fake, because we also know that when we take pictures of our food, it looks better on the picture than it actually did on the plate. But for somehow we delude ourselves when another person takes a picture of their, you know, beautiful wife and child on this glorious beach holiday. It truly is as idyllic as that filter has made it appear. And it's cropping out, you know, the stretch marks and the screaming and the sunburn and the, you know, pollution in the beach behind them and all the other stuff. And it's beautifully, you know, filtered and cropped. And even though we do this ourselves, we present and curate this artificialized version of our life, we somehow cannot stop ourselves from believing that everyone else actually is living their best life. And why am I missing out? And why am I sad? And why is my family not match up to that ideal? And why is my body doesn't look like that? And why can't I look like that? You know, and it just nags.
So I think before we totally depress ourselves, let's let's spend the last few minutes just reflecting on Christian responses and positive rules. I think from an individual point of view, one of the really interesting ideas is that we need to rediscover this idea of a rule of life, a daily rhythm to life, which pushes back against this addictive, always on digital culture, which is damaging us. And we instead go back to these ancient practices of imposing a rhythm on every day. Do you think that there's something in that? What about yourself? Are you going to adopt a rule of life, Tim?
You want me to become a monk? Is that what you're saying?
You do have a child. I don't. Yeah,
yeah, that is. And a wife. Yeah, it is challenging. I think there is. I'm fascinated by the kind of surge of interest, including outside the church, actually, in kind of Benedictine spirituality, which is all, you know, deriving from Saint Benedict, the guy who invented the rule of life in the medieval era, and kind of the modern idea of monasticism. You know, you see lots of businesses talking about Benedictine and all that stuff. I think it is intriguing, and I think there's certainly truth in the idea, which actually Christians have always known, which is that our broken, sinful world has a corrupting influence, and part of our spirituality has to be about building defenses against being dragged along with, you know, I mean, Paul writes about that, you know, do not let your minds be conformed to the ways of this world. And so I think what Christians have learned over many years, sometimes called the spiritual disciplines, you know, habits like daily prayer, meditation, worship, silence, you know, all these things. Richard Foster wrote the definitive book on this. These are practical habits and ways, rhythms that people have found over the years do help them you know, embody the virtues and the values that they seek, derive ultimately from the person of Jesus, and avoid being just swept up in whatever the world has to offer. So yeah, I think there's definitely value in that. It feels ambitious to live that way in contemporary life when you're not actually a medieval monk.
Yes, and particularly when both of us have had professions, you in news, me in medicine, which really cut across a sort of really nice 9-to-5, five days a week, you know, because the news cycle is 24/7, medicine works 24/7, shift patterns, and so on. So I think that how you implement some kind of rule of life in this kind of really chaotic shift-based working practices is a huge question. But I do intuitively sense that a lot of this is right, that we somehow have to wrest control away from the technology. I'm speaking to myself as much as to anybody else, and to try to implement regular practices over the day, and also like over a week. So the idea of having special times, you know, digital fasting, maybe the idea that the, you know, when we meet together as Christians, this should be a safe space away from technology. You know, that
hand your phone in at the door of church.
Yeah, exactly. And we are somehow protected from it. I think the other thing, finally, as we come to the end, is this is a huge issue for parents, isn't it? And, you know, you must be looking at your young daughter and thinking, you know, what are we going to do with technology? How are you going to protect your daughter from the ravages of capitalism? There is some interesting work. Again, we're going to put it in some books and other writings in this area. We're going to put some links into the notes for this episode. But the idea of developing families which have practices to try and push back against the smartphone. I think the really interesting idea is that in order to try and wean their children off the digital devices, parents have to make home time, family time, time spent together, even more interesting, even more exciting, even more attractive than this world out there, which is constantly wanting to suck your children into it.
Yeah, and it's certainly something that I am, you know, trying to think about now as a young father, and realizing even at 2.5 that our daughter is absolutely fascinated, entranced by anything with a screen. You know, even this morning she was playing with the, you know, the monitor that we use to look at her while she sleeps. You know, it's just anything with a screen, anything that lights up and has noise and is completely, even at that age, is somehow hacking into the neural networks of her brain and it is becoming quite addictive. But then you realize, actually, hang on, where is she learning this? She's learning this from me, because I sit on the sofa while I'm spending time with her, but I'm really checking Twitter and reading the news and checking up my emails and my WhatsApps. And so, yeah, I think there's enormous value. I haven't remotely even begun to achieve this, but in as a family setting a pattern, you know, classic examples are, you know, don't charge your phone in the same room where you sleep. You know, have kind of Sabbath times from your devices, you know, develop habits where maybe on a certain hour in the evening or a day a week where everyone puts their phones away or whatever it is. None of this is easy, particularly for someone, you know, where I can't really Sabbath a lot of the time because my phone and my laptop are essential to how I do my job, which also is from home. So it is tricky. But yeah, I think it's certainly something that our generation of kind of parents just cannot avoid, because I think you can see from a terrifyingly young age just how effective the surveillance capitalists have done at making their devices, their apps, their products completely enthralling to young minds.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting and important topic, and it'd be good to come back to it in a future episode and maybe invite someone on as a guest who's got special expertise in this area. But I think it seems to me that as Christian people, we're right at the beginning. I mean, this wave of stuff has hit us, and we're only just beginning to get our heads around what's going on and how on earth to try to respond. But it is happening, and I'm really quite excited and encouraged to see these new initiatives, and I hope we'll be able to explore that in future episodes.
Definitely, and we haven't got time to go into any depth, but just as a parting thought, I stumbled across some Christians writing about surveillance capitalism, and they said ultimately we need to resist the allure of disembodiment and kind of return to embodiment. You know, digital technology is all about, as we talked about, dehumanizing and alienating ourselves, and, you know, broadcasting yourself to the masses. But Jesus, God, came as a single person, completely finite, limited, as one man in one place in history, for just a few years. And there's something intrinsic to our spirituality, I think, as Jesus followers, which is to mark our lives after that and embrace our finitude, our limitedness, and kind of resist the allure of the kind of infinite, always on projection that that digital technology suggests.
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't it most profound and fascinating that, that the most central act of Christian worship, which is the breaking of bread, the Eucharist, the communion, is the physical sharing together of a group of people. We are one body because we all share in one bread. That, and that cannot be digitized. That is something that you have to do in the flesh.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I hope that's kind of scratched the surface, at least, of some of the big ideas. We're really interested to hear any of your thoughts on what you think about surveillance capitalism, what it's taking from us. Should we fear it? How can we respond well as Christians? Please do get in touch. MOLAD, MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. We'll put some links of further reading in the notes of this podcast, but there's also plenty to read on tech and how it's kind of shaping our society on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, goodbye.
Hello, Tim here. Just before we go, I wanted to let you know we're planning a special episode in the next month or so to mark the 1 year anniversary of relaunching Matters of Life and Death as part of the Premier Unbelievable Network. We're going to be dedicating an episode, or maybe even two, to answering questions from you, our listeners. They can be on any topic, perhaps something you've heard us talk about over the last year that you'd like to go deeper into, or maybe instead there's a new development in the news or science that you'd be interested to hear us chat about. We can't promise to answer every question we get, but we're definitely going to try to squeeze in as many as possible into this special omnibus episode. Nothing's out of bounds, so do get in touch now by emailing MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.